Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller, and drinker of Forsythia, the only known non-cure for coronavirus. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Just embracing the chaos, man.
I'm surviving.
That's good. That's good. Before we get started with the show, I wanted to fill our loyal listeners in on a special promo we are running as our nation enters or continues to stretch into lockdown mode. For a limited time, you can get 2 months of access to everything at RebellerMedia.com for free. That's nada, nothing, Zippo, free. You will find the offer at the top left corner of RebellerMedia.com right there on the homepage. I hope you will check it out. I will make sure to send plenty of links to it on Twitter and possibly in the description of this podcast. The bad news is you're locked away at home. But the good news is if you click on that Originals tab up at the top of the site, we have a treasure trove of content for you to sift through. Start with the Original Outlaw series by Jacob Q. Knight and the Profiles in Badass series by Outlaw Vern. Each essay will provide you weeks of lockdown entertainment. We're paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access. After the free period ends, it's just $2 a month. $2 a month. That's less than most Patreons, and you get so much more bang for your buck. Up first, controversies and non-controversies / notes from Hollywood's collapse. As this segment evolves, we will keep evolving with it. Big news out of China this morning, just this morning, we're taping this on Friday, as that nation's theaters, including the 200 that had just reopened in megalopolis Shanghai, abruptly closed again today. As someone who watched the coronavirus not as a health crisis so much, but as a business concern, tracking theater closures as they migrated out of Wuhan to China at large, and then beyond that country's borders to Italy, Spain, and finally America, I will be honest with you, this is pretty terrifying news. And it is also a concrete indication that China is completely and utterly full of crap when it says that it has the disease under control. There's some question as to how much we should care at this point about the origins of the virus, what we should call it, et cetera, et cetera. I would suggest that it is of vital importance not to accede to the demands of China's in-house propagandists by downplaying the role the authoritarian regime has played in spreading this virus and covering up its severity. But I might be wrong. It's been known to never happen. Peter, should we believe what China says about the status of coronavirus in the Forbidden Kingdom, or should we pay attention to what it does with its movie theaters?
We should pay attention to what it does with its movie theaters. I'm not saying that China is completely making up every single thing they are telling us, but we should definitely be skeptical of any of the information that they put out in terms of the spread of coronavirus, in terms of the status of their efforts to control it. The Chinese government wants to look like they are in control. And in many ways, you know, they exert a lot of control in an authoritarian sense over their population. But to do that, one of the things they do is lie, especially to outsiders, but also to their own population. We know this in part because in January, after the coronavirus had already been spreading in China for at least a month at that point, China was still claiming that it couldn't be passed by human-to-human contact. And now what they want to look like is that they've got everything under control, like they've figured it out, like their system of lockdowns and just sort of total population control is the right one. And I'm not saying we know for certain that they are lying about every single thing, but the theaters closing is a very strong sign that they do not believe they have this under control. The other thing that we should talk about, just since this is a movies podcast, is that beyond the kind of public health stuff and the what it tells you about the authoritarian nature of China's government, it also really highlights the danger of giving the Chinese government so much power and influence over American pop culture, and in specific, the movie industry. And we've talked about this before with regards to things like basketball and video games. This has come up. But this the power of the Chinese government over both what films get played in China, their kind of soft power over the content of those films, and then their ability to just sort of open theaters or close them without really explaining what's going on, and thus to deprive Hollywood of millions and millions in revenues, to kind of throw a huge wrench into the decisions that Hollywood is making, which are already incredibly complicated given the situation. It really, really underlines how risky a move it was to basically make the Chinese government a partner in every Hollywood studio and their development process.
Alyssa, let's take a crack at that real quick, because I do think there's something to be said for the decoupling that we may be seeing from America and China writ large, right? Like, I do think that there is going to be a growing concern about the amount of interconnectedness, let's say, between Chinese manufacturing and American manufacturing, Chinese rules and laws, and America's way of life. Do you think that this could be a breaking point in the special relationship between Hollywood and China?
I don't know. I mean, my husband and I were talking about this the other day, and I was saying I hoped that, you know, American companies might think about bringing some of their more sensitive supply chains back to the United States. And he said, and I think probably not unjustifiably, that, you know, the bottom line is the bottom line. And I'm not even sure that a pandemic of global scale would convince American companies to walk away from either the savings that Chinese manufacturing represents for the supply chain or the box office dollars that are available in China. I mean, so much of the entertainment industry's, you know, business plan at this point involves making massive amounts of money overseas for a couple of tentpole movies that effectively props up the rest of their operations. And, you know, if they are going to decide to potentially forego Chinese revenue, that is going to prompt a huge reckoning throughout Hollywood, not just for the couple of movies they get access there every year, but for all of the other movies that are dependent on the performance of those movies for their funding. And so, you know, let me put it this way. I would never bet against American capitalism trying to maximize profits. I think that's probably a subject on which you and I agree, Sunny. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question, right? You know, and I think it's worth noting that, as Peter described, I mean, China doesn't just want to talk about how its, you know, its lockdowns worked. It's trying to use this as an opportunity to sort of reassert its soft power in a number of ways. One of the reasons that China was eager to get its movie theaters reopened is because it had forbidden domestic distributors from selling the movies that were initially going to be released in theaters to streaming services. They had a plan to re-release old blockbusters to try and get people back in movie theaters. And so this was supposed to be a moment of where, you know, the Chinese movie business could kind of assert itself on a world stage. And they're doing that as well with healthcare. I mean, part of the you know, argument has been not just that the lockdowns worked, but China is offering medical aid to other countries stricken by COVID-19. And, you know, I think that it will be interesting to see if the Chinese leadership's gamble on that sort of succeeds.
Well, they're sending testing kits out around the world that don't work. I mean, did you see the story that, like,
yeah,
I think only 30% of the kits they sent to the Czech Republic or somewhere were effective? I mean, I have to say, I'm like, of all of these storylines that have emerged from this specific crisis and the way we have reacted to it, the one I have been most annoyed by, like, kind of on a simmering level and like getting more and more annoyed, is the sort of like speech policing, the saying, you know, oh, you can't call it the Wuhan coronavirus, you can't call it the Chinese coronavirus, because that's racist. And first off, that's an explicitly Chinese, like, reading on this. They were the ones who were suggesting that it was racist first, and then everybody just kind of picked up on that. But also, I'm sorry, that's just a description of where it's from. And also, you guys, the Chinese government, I'm not saying the Chinese people, I'm not saying Chinese Americans or Chinese students here in America, but the Chinese government botched the rollout of stopping it. And I'm like, I get like more and more annoyed every time somebody tries to like shift this around and say, well, look, let's lay off China for a little while. You know, we're all on this together. The Chinese are not acting like we're all on this together.
Well, and
it's just not.
And look, I think that it is really unfortunate that the disease's apparent origins in Wuhan have meant that people in the United States and around the world have been attacked, right? I mean, that is that's a tragic add-on to the toll of the virus. My colleague Josh Rogan at the Washington Post had a really good piece saying, you know, you don't have to blame the Chinese people, but you can blame the Chinese Communist Party for how this has been handled. And I think that trying to just draw that distinction is, you know, a politically useful thing to do. It's accurate. But I do think, I mean, the Chinese people were the first to die in large numbers from this, and finding ways to stand in solidarity with them and against the government that suppressed information that could have saved their lives is the place that we should all be in.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, well, I think we can all agree that that the Chinese government is not the hero of this story, as much as they are trying to shift that around in their favor.
And look, it would be one thing if the Chinese government actually had figured out a foolproof containment strategy, was reporting its numbers honestly, and was shipping out technology that actually worked, right? I mean, if we ended up in a situation where China had a legitimate claim to lead the world in this situation, I would take their help, because clearly the United States is not exactly stepping up to the plate. But trying to claim global hegemony with test kits that don't work, with lies, that is something that that is a really ugly kind of opportunism, and it will kill people, and we should stand against it.
Regardless of what's going on in China, I think we can all agree that Back to Business by Easter was always a bit premature. That's a lot of wishful thinking. And you would have known that and understood my Forsythia joke above if you had seen Contagion, Steven Soderbergh's documentary about the year 2020 that he somehow filmed in 2011. Contagion is a fascinating beast, something like Ocean's 11 for the CDC. It's got a star-studded cast featuring, among others, Matt Damon, Gwyneth Paltrow, Lawrence Fishburne, Bryan Cranston, Kate Winslet, and more. It's got a twisty, turny plot that asks us to try and unravel a mystery at the same time as the characters are doing so. And it's got more drama than you would expect from something that feels so true to life, especially now that we're living through something similar. It was kind of funny to watch it over the weekend and, you know, hear all the talk about social distancing and, you know, that good stuff that we have come to live with in such a short period of time. Alyssa, when you rewatched Contagion recently, what struck you the most? Was it the bickering over how strongly to respond to something like this in the face of previous scares that didn't pan out, like H1N1? Was it the way people wanted to carry on despite the disaster looming? Or were you, like me, most impressed by Matt Damon's realization that the most important thing in a time like this is a cold, hard firearm with which you can defend your precious teenage daughter from horny boys who are willing to risk life and death for a quick kiss?
I think that the thing that impressed me most about it is, I mean, it's a great procedural movie. I think this was, Contagion was one of my favorite movies of the last, you know, 15 years. And even though watching it again is really, really, really unnerving. But I think the thing that scared the bejesus out of me most while watching it is the extent to which the president of the United States is basically turning into Alan Crumwoody, the villain of the movie, in so much as the movie has a villain, played by Jude Law, who is a conspiracy-minded blogger who sees the potential of the virus early, both as a public health menace and as an opportunity to basically do a whole bunch of insider trading by pushing a bogus cure for the virus that's at the center of the movie, which is known as MEV1. And the fact that the president has spent the past couple of weeks sort of blathering on about cures that may or may not have potential at all, especially since the person who published the paper touting the idea that these drugs work has been accused of falsifying data in the past, is really kind of terrifying. And so it's not even so much that we are living through a global pandemic like the one depicted in the movie, but we're living through a global pandemic where the villains are doing exactly the same kind of sort of scary thing that we see in the movies. So it's been wild.
Peter, I wonder if you could just break down the difference between this and Outbreak from the perspective of, like, movies about our times. Why Outbreak looks so, like, ridiculous and dated, while Contagion kind of holds up as something that, you know, makes sense right now?
Outbreak is fundamentally a star-driven 90s action thriller. And you know, it was originally set to star Harrison Ford, who would go on to make Air Force One, a movie about a terrorist attack on the president on Air Force One, also directed by Wolfgang Peterson. And it basically follows the same formula, which is, you know, one man and his kind of close team of assistants against the world. And it's an action movie at heart. It has a kind of science-y premise, but it's not really concerned with getting the science, the procedure, the social breakdown aspect of it right at all. What it's concerned with is giving Harrison Ford, who ended up being played by Dustin Hoffman, a bunch of stuff to like kind of run around and do and fly through a canyon and like, you know, have
and
some
a chance to jump off right? a helicopter onto right. a merchant vessel. Yes.
Which a scene that was toned down for for Dustin Hoffman. He specifically talked about how when it was Harrison Ford, it was going to be like this wild flying leap or something. And with Dustin Hoffman, it was just like a little hop. In terms of capturing what is happening in the reality of the situation, also just in kind of terms of skilled movie making, I certainly think Contagion is a better film, right? It takes on a really difficult challenge of making something that is both fairly accurate and true to life, feels realistic, and also incredibly tense and dramatic. And doing that is really hard, and Steven Soderbergh is one of the few directors who can do it. But I have to say, in some ways, I enjoyed watching Outbreak more. And I'll tell you why. It's because Outbreak didn't make me terrified. And watching Contagion in this environment was a personally nerve-wracking experience that I almost wanted to stop. And I think if I hadn't had to watch it for this show, I thought I was going to rewatch it. And I think I probably would have turned it off at some point and just said, I don't want to think about this anymore. I'm not sure I want to expose my brain to this.
At this,
really, because I'm fascinated by this. And maybe, Alyssa, you're with me on this too, because I found it actually modestly reassuring for a couple of reasons. First off, the disease and Contagion is kind of far-fetchedly dangerous. Both in terms of the virus itself and like how fast people die from it, but also just in terms of kind of how quickly it transmits. I see what's happening now, and like, you know, we're in like kind of a slow motion disaster with the hospitals, and maybe we're able to, you know, stave that off with enough ventilators and enough social distancing. But I do think that. While I'm watching this movie happen, I'm like, well, at least it's not that bad. At least it wasn't quite that scary. I don't know.
Doesn't it make you afraid though that it could get that scary? And that to me is not that it is going to end, that we're going to end up with a case fatality rate of 20-30%, but that the social breakdowns and disorder that start to show up in the second half of the film that become in some ways just as maybe not just as deadly as the disease, but that contribute to the overall sense of danger in society. I guess that is, it worried me. And it worried me that if that happened, given where we are in terms of our ability to respond to these things and how flailing we have been, that we wouldn't respond to it well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're not at a place where the supply chain is breaking down. The attempted cures that people are trying are things that like you can't get, blood plasma with antibodies at your local pharmacy. So we're not going to see runs in the pharmacies. I think the place where we could start to see really challenging social environments is if the migrant workers who harvest a lot of our crops get COVID-19, and considering the conditions that a lot of them live in, that would be a disaster, both epidemiologically and economically. I think if the supply chain gets really disrupted, I mean, if China gets shut down again, this time for 6 months instead of 2 or 3, but I don't think we're at that place yet. And I think that one caution about that is that as much as we've seen people scam and lie. We've also seen enormous amounts of mutual aid work. We've seen, you know, tens of thousands of retired doctors come back into service to get ready to fight the pandemic. We've seen remarkable charitable efforts, sort of local mutual aid. And so as much as I am really frightened and upset about what's happening in the United States right now, that is not the thing that concerns me at the moment. And I think the thing that I found comforting about Contagion, which I find equal part sort of incredibly effective horror movie and balm, is that it really reaffirms the values that we're going to need if we live through this. Generosity, thinking about others, people taking on personal risks so they can try and help other people. I mean, to me, one of the most amazing scenes in the movie is when Kate Winslet's character, a doctor who's been sent out by the CDC to investigate this outbreak in Chicago, realizes that she's sick. And the first thing that she does is calls the staff of the hotel where she's staying and tries to get the contact info of everyone who serviced her room, who brought her room service, so she can try to keep them safe too. And it's, I mean, it's not until she's made all of those phone calls that she calls her boss and says, "I think I'm sick." And that is, it's a quiet scene, but it's incredibly heroic in a way that is totally different from the heroism in Outbreak, but is a kind of heroism that is achievable by ordinary people and is something that we're going to desperately need in the months ahead.
Kate Winslet is so good in this. Too.
Yeah.
I love that scene as well, Alyssa, because it does an interesting screenplay thing, which is that essentially we're watching this scene play out. We see she has realized she's sick. We see she's sitting there writing something, and we're thinking, or at least I was thinking at home, oh, she's writing a goodbye letter, right? This is her dramatic, you know, I love you, family and husband and child or whatever. This is her like goodbye letter to the world. And then she like turns the light on and picks up the phone and is like, I need the names of all the people who have been here. And we realize that she's actually doing something useful in the face of this crisis, which is kind of what the whole movie is about. It's like, how can you be the most useful in this situation? It's a fascinating little screenplay thing that I think it contributes to the overall sense of realism of the picture, but also just like is what makes it feel so different from essentially anything else in this vein.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that I think that it does really well is that it doesn't, I mean, the closest thing to a straightforward hero the movie has is Jennifer Eale's character. She's the doctor who eventually develops and tests a vaccine for MEV1 on herself. But almost everyone in the movie is on some level morally compromised by the circumstances that they're in. I mean, Ellis Cheever, Lawrence Fishburne's character, is, you know, directing the effort to trace and understand the disease at the CDC, and ultimately does something both incredibly understandable and totally immoral when he tells his fiance to get out of Chicago early because the city's going to be locked down. And there's this moment when John Hawkes, who plays the like a janitor at the CDC, who's friendly with Cheever, he overhears him and says, you know, we've all got people. And it's this moment. I mean, what Cheever does is not horrifying on a grand scale, but it is an illustration of how you need to preserve sort of collective morality and how hard that is to do. It's a movie that doesn't pretend that doing any of this is easy or come without cost. You know, the impact of, you know, Mitch Emhoff's sort of quarantine with his daughter and shutting down her social life to protect her is really painful. And the movie doesn't pretend that it's not difficult, but he does it anyway. And that is what makes him heroic. It's a movie about doing all of the little hard things. And I found it really moving and really scary, but really moving.
Peter, what was the scariest part for you? You said you were scared. What was the scariest thing? The one scariest thing where you're like, oh, crap, this is going to happen.
I think there were sort of two related parts. Like I said, the thing that sort of got me was the social breakdown, and you see the kind of near riots or rioting that happen as the government officials are passing out MREs and they run out of food. Again, that hasn't happened here, and the food supply chain looks pretty good, at least for the moment. But then you combine that with what the movie shows us about the government response. And for the most part, the government response in Contagion is reasonably competent and reasonably effective. And yet still, things still got as bad as they did. And what we've seen in the United States has not been a complete failure, but it has been pretty disastrous in many ways, starting with the CDC botching the rollout and the development of the test kits, starting with the FDA declining to take good advice from the former head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, who said that they should be licensing private test makers to develop mass testing for people. And then, of course, going up to the president of the United States, who spent most February saying that this was just not a big deal, that the numbers were low and could even go down to zero. And, you know,
and it was
the economy
like the flu,
is great and strong.
Yeah.
Right. And so the chaos in the movie happened even with a really competent, really earnest, really smart government response and people who knew what they were doing, acting smartly and together in a coordinated way. We're getting better at it. The government responses has improved over the last several weeks, but we don't really have that. And we are going to have problems developing that, in part because of some of our partisan political disputes, in part because of just kind of the nature of who is in charge right now, and in part because of the nature of how the federal bureaucracy works, right? The CDC did what it did because they were following the ordinary procedures for developing flu test kits that are put in place so that we don't end up with tests that are different and therefore can't be compared to each other. And so it really just sort of, I was anxious watching all of that and thinking that on the one hand, it's nice that we have not seen those sort of social breakdowns, not just in the United States, but anywhere. We have not seen, you know, kind of mass rioting, that sort of violence, chaos that the movie depicts in any of the countries that have taken even measures stronger and stricter than the United States has taken. And that's heartening to think about. On the other hand, you know, we're still early in this. And I guess I guess part of me, I'm a bit of a worrier and a bit of an extrapolator from trends. And part of me thinks, well, you know, it's really hard to see what life is going to be like 4, 6, or 8 weeks from now. And this is Contagion. Part of the reason it works is because it offers such an effective and seemingly realistic vision of where things could go.
Yeah. And I was actually talking to Scott Burns, who wrote this movie earlier in the week as part of my day job. And he said, and I think he won't mind me saying this because he said it elsewhere, that, you know, all of the information in the movie was out there all along, right? I mean, all he had to do was ask people who know things about pandemics to do the research for the movie. But the one thing he did not imagine was a government response like this. And I thought that was really telling, that you can be, you know, you can imagine a really horrifying virus. You can imagine, you know, people having a selfish, collectively corrosive response to the deadliness of that virus. But even when you're imagining the sort of apocalyptic scenario, a person writing this movie still assumes that the government is basically going to work. And I think, look, there obviously have been heroic people in this situation in government. I mean, I think Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx have done a pretty amazing job of communicating with the American people about what's going on. But yeah, I mean, I thought that said something about sort of the power of imagination and what our core assumptions are.
The medical advisor on this, it's actually worth noting, just got COVID-19. And the head, the chief person who was in charge of telling Burns and the crew sort of how this would play out and sort of giving them scientific advice, now has the virus.
Yay. We're all going to get it. Okay. Well, so looking back now, thumbs up or thumbs down on the documentary Contagion?
I think it's a fantastic movie, but really, really don't watch it if you can't handle it. And be serious with yourself about whether you can handle it, because it's scary as hell.
It's an incredibly well-made movie. Yeah, thumbs up. It's an incredibly well-made movie. I thought so when it came out. I still think so. It's just even more nerve-wracking now than it was then. And honestly, I found it pretty nerve-wracking when I saw it in 2011.
Yeah, I give it a thumbs up as well, and I just want to relay my story of watching it for the first time. So I didn't see it till 2013 or so, something like that. And when I watched it, after I watched it, I felt sick afterwards, and I was like, oh, you know, this is all in my head. I'm just, you know, psychosomatic, blah blah blah. And my wife Beth had to go out of town, so I was like, I'll be fine. Well, she goes, and like literally like 3 hours after she leaves, my fever spikes to like 103. I have to like, I'm like trying to take my dog out. I'm living in an apartment complex in Washington D.C. at the time, and I'm like leaning against the brick wall, like just like holding on for dear life so I don't fall down and die right there. Yeah, it turned out I had a viral pneumonia, so that was fun, but it was a very important lesson on the power of film, which is like it gets in your head. And the only reason I didn't go to a doctor sooner than that was because I was thinking, this movie was just so good that I've made myself sick. So thumbs up from me. I think it's one of Soderbergh's best. All right. This week's assigned viewing is Deepwater Horizon. Peter, why are we watching Peter Berg and Mark Wahlberg's disaster picture?
We are watching Deepwater Horizon in preparation for Spencer Confidential. Like Spencer Confidential, as you said, Deepwater is a collaboration between director Peter Berg and star Mark Wahlberg. It's the story of the 2010 oil platform disaster off the coast of Louisiana, and it is an intense and harrowing story of bravery and survival in the face of catastrophe. I don't always love Berg's movies. His Battleship, which, yes, is an adaptation of the board game that inexplicably adds aliens. And it's just one of the messiest.
It's very explicable. It's very explicable.
Right, because
Peter.
Why aliens.
Else would you have that?
You sunk my battleship. Yeah. Implicit in that is because of the aliens.
Because of the aliens.
Right? It's just one of the like messiest and sort of least effective blockbusters I can remember. And like a lot of his films, I actually think Deepwater is a bit over-directed. That said, it is remarkably effective, really quite well-paced with some great set pieces. It really makes the scale of the kind of just the violence, right? The deadly pressure that everyone on board was under, very real. And it also has a couple of great performances, particularly I think from Kurt Russell as Mr. Jimmy, who is the head of the crew that works on the Deepwater Horizon, but they work for, I guess, under sort of their contractors for BP Oil. And he just conveys a real sense of decency, leadership, authority, right? He's the person who we are supposed to understand had the right idea about the safety of the rig, who understood that it probably wasn't ready for prime time, and whose first concern was the safety of his men. And he does a really great job with the role. It's a little bit over-directed, just to sort of in Berg's use of shaky cam and quick cuts. But it's also really effective, and I hadn't seen it before, and I was really glad actually to be able to watch it.
Alyssa?
I really like this movie, and I think that it does something quite interesting in that it's a very, very technical movie, right? I mean, it has to explain an enormous amount of information about how drilling rigs work and the kind of maintenance that you do on them. And it manages to do that with a script that's really sort of loose and relaxed. It takes you sort of into the vernacular of the people who work on the rig together. And, you know, you have these arguments between the people who work on the rig and the BP executives, most notably Vidrine, played by John Malkovich. But it's also a movie about sort of blue-collar technical expertise and this sort of disjunction that has come about from having, you know, people who work for one company who are sort of subcontracted out to another. And the BP executives care about profit. They care about keeping the rig running. They don't want to take it offline to do the maintenance that everyone is telling them they should do. And they are, you know, Vidrine and the other executives on the Deepwater Horizon are, you know, white collar guys who are there to make sure that BP is getting the most out of their investment and their leasing deal on the platform. And they're ignoring the technical expertise of the blue collar workforce who's, you know, lives and works on the rig for extended hitches at a time. And the movie just manages to convey that in again, it's a really good script. It's a really like loose series of performances. You know, everyone on who plays one of the rig workers really gives the sense that these people have known each other for a long time. They've worked together for a long time. You know, the movie doesn't step out to do a lot of exposition, except in the scenes where Vidrine and Mr. Jimmy are arguing with each other. And it manages to take a really complex subject and render it in a really naturalistic and appealing and dramatic way. I mean, if Contagion is a movie about sort of the value of white collar expertise, Deepwater Horizon is a movie about the value of blue collar expertise and what happens when both of those sets of knowledge are sort of ignored or marginalized. And so in a way, they make really good companion pieces.
I remember thinking this at the time and thinking it again now. The thing about Deepwater Horizon is that it really is like a horror movie more than anything else. I mean, it has this sustained intensity to it that that I was kind of surprised that it did not get an R rating. Frankly, the violence and the kind of damage done to people via explosions and that sort of stuff. I mean, there's you know, Kurt Russell's, you know, kind of turned into hamburger for a large stretch of it, which is you know, hard to watch. It is very, very good, right? I'm not sure what else to say about it. I like it. Of all of the kind of Peter Berg, Mark Wahlberg, real life story movies, this was part of a series of films, more or less, right? With Lone Survivor and Patriot's Day, where you had Mark Wahlberg playing, you know, kind of normal guys in extraordinary situations and trying to see how they get through it. In Patriot's Day, it was the Boston Marathon bombing. He played a cop who was trying to figure out, you know, who did it and how to get people to safety. And then catch the guys after the fact, right? And then in Lone Survivor, which is very good. I like Lone Survivor a lot, actually. I shouldn't badmouth it too much, but it's another kind of one of these movies where you have like it's a smaller version of Black Hawk Down in a way, where you have four soldiers up against an entire village of insurgents and trying to figure out how to get out of it while also maintaining their decency. Right. The reason in Lone Survivor why the team ends up getting killed is because they choose not to essentially execute an Afghan boy. They let him go back to his village and he alerts the village to their presence. So I like kind of all of these movies, but I especially like the filmmaking in Deepwater Horizon because it is just so intense. And I'll disagree with Peter a little bit. I think the natural Berg aesthetic of the shaky cam actually works best here. It works better here than in anything else he has done, I think, just because of the nature of where the film takes place. I mean, it's on a platform that is itself shaking and about to explode and tear itself apart, right? It is bursting into flames all over the place. Like the natural Bergian aesthetic like fits the story that is being told perfectly. Don't you think, Peter? Or am I wrong here? Is it still just too annoying?
I don't find it nearly as annoying here as in some of his films. Like I said, Battleship, and in many cases, I think it basically works. That said, I sometimes found myself wishing that he would just hold still, or even not hold still, but hold on a single shot and let the camera move without cutting for just a little while longer. And it's not just that it was disorienting, it's that it was, which I think is right for this movie, it's that it was choppy and sort of seemed to kind of just, it's like he didn't ever quite get a complete shot. And so just put everything together by filming it 40 different times and using just the little chunks that worked best. And it seemed like he was a little bit like he was trying to cover not having shots that fully worked. I don't think that's actually what happened. I think that's just his style. It works better here than in most of his movies. It is really quite effective in a lot of ways. It's very well paced. One of the things that I thought was interesting was the explosion doesn't happen until midway through the movie. You are nearly, you're about 45, 50 minutes into the film before the explosion happens. And you mentioned this being like a horror film. That is classic horror movie stuff, right? Is to build and build until you get to the middle of the film before the stuff actually starts to happen, rather than to throw you into the action, you know, at the 15-minute mark or the 25-minute mark in the first act or in the break into the second act. He waits until the midpoint of the movie, and then everything really goes to hell. And so you have a lot of time both to get to know the characters and to understand the milieu and all the stuff that Alyssa was talking about in terms of explaining how these rigs work and what potential problems they might have. The movie actually gives itself space to do that and time to do that. And in some ways, that's, again, right, it sort of does this really clever thing, is it takes the form of a horror movie, except instead of building dread about the monster, it builds dread about mud and the tensile strength of concrete, which is what's going to ultimately kill people.
Well, and I think that the one mistake in the movie, more than the sort of shaky cam stuff, is the underwater CGI stuff that sort of tries to give you the monster's perspective. And I think it doesn't look that good. It doesn't communicate that much. And it's sort of a waste of time. And this is a fairly efficient movie. It's about an hour and 45 minutes, maybe a little bit longer. But that was the thing that struck me as just, I mean, it looks a little cheesy. It doesn't convey that much. And he could have done without it. But a thing that you do get from the sort of horror movie pacing and the slower start is a really fine performance by Mark Wahlberg. And, you know, I'm mixed on Wahlberg, but I think that part of what is really appealing and effective about this movie is how, you know, still and relatively quiet he is. I mean, the scenes where he's flirting with his wife, both in person and over, you know, sort of Skype calls on the rig, and she sort of starts to see that something is going on in the background, are very effective. And then, yeah, I mean, he has his big action movie moment where, you know, he tosses Gina Rodriguez overboard and saves her life. But the moment towards the end of the movie where he's walking onto shore and being accosted by this guy who wants to know if his son is alive. And I don't know that I've ever seen Mark Wahlberg like shrink into himself in a movie, but he does that here. And it's a case where, I mean, he's sort of been cast to type. I mean, if you look at the footage from hearings on the horizon, on the Deepwater Horizon disaster that appear at the end of the movie, I mean, he's got the same sort of physical type as the real Mike Williams. He's like a big guy. But the extent to which he plays against type in those scenes, where he's sort of breaking down in the hotel room, shrinking into himself when he's being accosted by this guy who's probably lost his son, are actually very effective. And I think it's to my mind, one of Wahlberg's sort of warmest and most charming performances. And I think he's very good in it, both for playing to type and against it.
I agree with that. And I would just add that the movie gets the vibe of the high performing, high skilled, good old boy.
Yep.
Really right. And I grew up on the Gulf Coast of Florida, not too far from the shore of Louisiana, where, you know, this is where this takes place. The beaches where I grew up were decimated for a time by the Horizon disaster. And it just, like, just not just the clothing, not just the kind of aesthetic and stylistic aspects. The movie just gets the sense of who these people are, how they carry themselves, how they think about themselves and their work, in a way that's respectful and true, and somewhat unusual for a portrayal of what are essentially kind of, you know, these are kind of rednecks. They're really good at their job, rednecks. And I mean that non-pejoratively, but like, they're the people I grew up with, and they are a real, you know, they're a real type, and very, very often in Hollywood they are portrayed cartoonishly and negatively. And this movie offers them a real kind of decency and respect and you know, moral authority.
Yeah, it's a smart movie about smart people who are often treated as if they're dumb, and the fact that people like Mike Williams are often treated as they're dumb is in fact part of the movie's horror, right? I mean, that is where things go wrong, is when people, you know, when people like Vadrine only see them as types and refuse to recognize their expertise.
All right. That's it for today. Assigned viewing for next week will be 28 Days Later, which is streaming on Hulu, and which we are watching to prepare for a discussion of Devs, the Alex Garland-helmed show on FX. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. And remember, for the next 2 months, it's free. Just look for that box at the top of the site for a link to the deal. If you love the show, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow a podcast audience. And if we don't grow, we die. We're like sharks. And review us at Apple. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sanye. Associate producer, Jessica Safa-Vamer. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.